welcome to the Ubuntu UK podcast.
I'm Tony.
And I'm Simon.
And what's coming up in episode 8?
Pretty much the same as last time, actually. We're going to clear all of the UDS interviews. I think we've got 5 of those.
And we're going to set a new competition, which is going to be a bit different from the last ones.
Yeah, lots of fun and games doing that one. Should be good.
Yes. Yeah, it's just Simon and I this time. Alan's not feeling very well, and Dave, we think, is lost somewhere around Hampshire.
So we're sat in the middle of a field, enjoying the lovely weather, and doing it from there.
Dave and I are at UDS with Matt Oquist from the Software Freedom Day project. Matt, Software Freedom Day has been going for a few years. How did it all come about? How did it start?
Well, sometime in the spring of 2004, I believe it was, I was driving past a major retailer in the US, Walmart, and I thought about all those CDs, those AOL CDs they have sitting in the front of their store and how useless they are. And I thought about all the free software that was available already at the time, high quality stuff like OpenOffice, for example, Firefox, the GIMP. I think those were at the top of my list. And I thought, wouldn't it be so cool if there were free CDs with free software? How much more valuable would that be for the community and for the people who pick them up? So one thing led to another. Contacted the local LUG. They pointed me to the OpenCD project and hopped on those forums and got in contact with Henrik Nilsson Oma and Phil Harper. And they immediately expressed interest in having some sort of organized day where people handed out free software CDs. We decided on the name Software Freedom Day. We decided to try to put the focus on a celebration of free software because that seemed to open up the idea beyond just handing out CDs. And it's grown from there. That was 2004. We had the first one in August of 2004. And we had just a handful of teams. I think it was about 10 or 15 teams.
And would that be teams in the U.S., or is it a global thing? Can anyone join in?
Absolutely anyone. I happen to live in the U.S., but Henrik lives in the U.K. Phil happens to live in the U.K. also. And we had board members from India and... my mind is blank. Forgive me, guys. We had board members from around the world right there in the first year, and we had celebrations around the world.
And what kind of things do people do on Software Freedom Day? Do they go to Walmart and replace the AOL CDs with Open CDs? Or, you know, what do people actually do to celebrate this event?
Well, we had to do things that were legal and friendly to the community. And so, unfortunately, we haven't been able to replace the AOL CDs with actual quality software. What we've had to do instead is encourage people to figure out and to strategize for their local community, for their local interest groups they're already involved with, and come up with the right way to pass on the message of software freedom in that context. So, for example, I think one of the most frequent plans for a Software Freedom Day event is to set up a booth at, say, a local library. Just put up a table, maybe have a banner behind it. We try... from our organization to send out some t-shirts and balloons, stuff like that, to make it a little bit more festive. And that catches attention. People come by in a library where they're already there to, you know, get free stuff. And in a library especially, you get a lot of the types of people who would be interested in something like Software Freedom. And you can talk to them about free software. Hand them a CD that's going to work on their computer. Make it easy for them to try out free software. So that's just one example, but also people do things on the street. We've had people do things at universities. Sometimes they have keynote addresses. Sometimes they actually have a celebration with cake, punch, cookies, stuff like that. I even recall a couple years ago, I think we had one team that did a candlelight vigil. Because in their community, that was the thing to do. There's a town square with a fountain there, and if you have a cause or a concern, you go there and set up a display of candles and hold a vigil. So that's what they did for Software Freedom Day.
So you actually give out CDs containing free software. Is that the OpenCD project?
Well, in the beginning, we provided a customized downloadable CD, a customized OpenCD, and teams had to burn it themselves. But of course, it's a little bit scary to... hand somebody, you know, to be handed a burned CD in the street with, you know, magic marker written on the top. In fact, my first Software Freedom Day, I had to spend the whole day convincing people I wasn't handing them pirated Windows. So we needed something better than that. And fortunately, right after Software Freedom Day in 2004, Canonical was getting off the ground, and Henrik was connected with Canonical and said to Mark Shuttleworth, "Hey, we've got this Software Freedom Day thing starting up, and we think you could maybe help us with some nice CDs." And so since that time, Canonical has been contracted with the corporation that we founded, Software Freedom International, and Canonical provides us every year with professionally pressed CDs that contain Ubuntu and free software for Windows. And Canonical even takes care of getting those CDs shipped out to the teams around the world, which is fantastic.
But it's by no means a requirement of any team that are doing this that they have to give that out. Obviously, if they want to give out, you know, GNUSense or, you know, some other distribution that they're familiar with that they would feel happy supporting, you're okay with that as well, aren't you?
Absolutely. We're perfectly happy with any team handing out any, I'm going to say, open source or free software. As long as software freedom is the point and the software that they hand out is free software, that's fine with us.
And when's the next one?
The next one is September 20th. We pick the third Saturday of September every year.
Do you have any advice for people who are thinking of contributing, thinking of getting involved, like the sound of this, and wonder, what do I do next? Where do I go?
Yes, the best thing to do is go to softwarefreedomday.org, and we have a registration system set up. So within the next couple weeks, though, we anticipate having the 2008 registration system up and running. And if you go there and register to lead a team in your community, we're just going to want some details about your plan so that we know that we're sending supplies and materials to somebody who's actually going to do something with them. And you can tell us also what kind of size you expect, how many people you expect to come by your event, so we have an idea whether we should send you 5 CDs, 10 CDs, or 100 CDs, for example. And we'll go from there.
So how many CDs do you know were actually given out last year?
Well, the contract that we have with Canonical actually sets the number at 15,000. And we've been doing that each year since that contract started in 2005.
But of course, people, if they have their own stock of CDs, they can give those out as well. So in theory, it could be a much larger number than that, in fact.
Yes, it can be much larger, and actually I think it is. I know that a lot of teams have burned their own CDs. Sometimes we have shipping problems. You know, shipping internationally is pretty complicated, and people end up burning stuff at the last minute. So another piece of advice is to plan ahead, and even better than that, register early so that we can get your stuff early.
Personally, I have some good memories of Software Freedom Day. There was, I think it was 2006, I went to London and we gave out some CDs. We did a walk from our meetup point to a university where a talk was given by a Canonical person. And along the way, we stopped off outside a computer store and we're giving out CDs to customers. It was all perfectly legit and the people in the shop were perfectly fine with us so long as we weren't inside the store and harassing the customers. But we had some great conversations with members of the public who couldn't quite understand why we were doing it. And yeah, we've had people asking us if it was religious, if it was a cult, and even a bus driver we handed a CD and he said, "Oh, is this that replacement for Windows?" And we were like, "Yes, that's exactly what it is." Are there any particular memories that you have been passed to you about Software Freedom Day over the years that, you know, you feel happy about?
Yes, I think that the most fun I had on Software Freedom Day was probably a year that I was at an event in a public library, and we had a steady stream of people all day, and we got all those same types of questions. And you get to talk to people about free culture, and you get to talk to people about digital rights management, or DRM, and the ways that limits what we can do, and it's stultifying to our culture, to production of music and all those kinds of things. And that's actually, a lot of people are interested in that topic because of the MP3 downloading issues that are going on and all of that kind of stuff. I think even more than that, though, my favorite moment was when a mother walked in with kids in tow, you know, one on the arm and a couple in tow, and we handed her an Ubuntu CD, and she said, and I kind of, you know, I gave her the two-sentence version of what it was going to do, and she said, "Wow, this will really, really help us out because we just can't afford to upgrade our computer." And I was floored. I thought, that's, out of all the reasons to do this, that's my favorite one, to make a difference like that in somebody's life.
Fantastic. And long may it continue. So thanks for coming along and talking to us, Matt.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Okay, so Tony and Alan here at UDS still. And we're here with Celeste, who works on the KDE project, amongst other things. And what's most interested you here at UDS then, Celeste?
Well, obviously all the Kubuntu stuff, but I sat in on a lot of the other desktop, especially the desktop experience sessions, and it was interesting to see how they were going through whatever experience and problem solving and trying to fix workflows and bugs and interface issues.
What do you kind of bring to the table, for want of a better word?
Yeah, I'm most certainly not a programmer. It's a little bit unfortunate. I have some programming experience, but I sort of veered off into design and interaction and user interface before I really learned like how KD is structured, because KD is, there's a lot of libraries and you have to learn the libraries before you can touch anything. And I mean, I know basic syntax, logic, that sort of thing, and I'd love to go in there and fix a label or move a button, but I just can't get over that learning curve. Most of the time it is consulting. People either come to me or I'll do a report and go to them. Usually I'll contact whoever is maintaining the thing that I'm looking at and say, hey, I'm going to look at this. Is that okay? Because I don't want to spend time that I could be using on a different project, go and review an interface, come up with solutions, that sort of thing, and then they're too busy or they don't want it. So.
And are developers eager to take your advice, or do you have to ram it down their throats a bit?
Well, since there's sort of this two-way agreement where, yeah, I want to work with you and sure, I'll work with you, for the most part, they're expecting it. Sometimes I do have to convince them. And it's really a skill. Like, there are things that I think, like usability, a lot of people think is personal preference. To a lot of people, that is probably right, because they don't understand all that, like, usability is just one small part of all kinds of things, like the whole user experience. I mean, you have business goals, marketing goals, product technical limitations, interaction design, like all these other things, right? And usability is just one small part of it. And it's sometimes I do have to justify myself. I mean, I'll go as far as pull out research that says this is why you do it this way, so that, I mean, it's up to them to develop it at the end, but if they want to continue working with me, usually they'll at least work with me. I don't always have the right solution all the time, because I'm not aware of all the other limitations or all the bug reports that are out there, or what other people have been saying, or maybe I didn't see somebody else's UI before and that's how they solve the problem. But my say isn't final. I'm going to work with them until we come up with something that's better than the broken thing that I found.
Is there something that we should be doing as a community to help get more
foster this?
Get more people involved?
Yeah, well, there are really two problems. Well, I don't know. It depends on how small of problems you want to look at. There could be more than two problems. There are definitely a lack of designers in open source. That's a hard problem to really attack, because there's no motivation for designers to get involved. I happened to be a computer geek in college, and then I went off towards like the design world, and I kept my open source roots. So that's kind of how I got involved. And same thing with the other people that I know. They either got interested in open source and free culture and then got involved in Linux, or they were computer geeks and sort of took the psych design end and got involved that way. So we all had original ties to open source or Linux or whatever to start with.
Getting back to KDE, mm-hmm. You've got a new release that's on the way. It's here, but it's in
4.1.
Kind of development at the moment, still under very active
yes.
development. And I understand there's the new HIG, the Human Interface Guidelines for KDE. Do you think this will help improve KDE even further, both KDE 4 and the HIG together?
I hope so. The KDE 4 Human Interface Guidelines was a project we started more years ago than I would like to admit, and unfortunately died down a little bit before 4.0 started, because the two primary people who were working on it got busy with real life and our careers, and the developers for 4.0 were already so busy that even if we had something to give them, I'm not sure that they would have had time to really work on it, because 4.0 was really a architecture release, and so applications were getting ported. They weren't necessarily getting redesigned and reevaluated and, you know, going through a real, like, scrub. It's just more like, let's get it working with our new libraries. This summer, however, we have two interns. During the season of usability, It's open usability sort of take on the Google Student Summer of Code. Ellen Reitmeier and myself are mentoring two design students to work on the human interface guidelines. And so we'll be writing the guidelines, but we're also focusing on design patterns and practical examples so that you'll have screenshots and like annotations and stuff. So whenever you go and look up a specific issue, you'll be able to actually see it in action. And depending on how much time we have and how extensive we get and how great our interns are, you know, how much content will exist. I already have a huge list of things that just over the past month since I thought of it to start writing down these things, questions about the human interface guidelines. It's in my head, it's in Ellen's head, we just haven't been able to write it down because it's just so much content. I mean, the GNOME Interface Guidelines is a big document, but it's kind of vague in a lot of areas. It's not very specific for especially edge cases, and all the questions I get are for edge cases. And of course, I can think about it for a second and be like, oh, well, you should do it that way. But how do you just put random guidelines in a document and have somebody be able to either both look them up or read them through like a book and understand them?
Yeah, it's not particularly scalable. We need a lot of you. Yeah. Around yeah, to answer those
yeah,
questions.
Yeah, but it's not, I mean, Ellen and I happen to have the same views on how certain things should work. So usually if I say something or she says something, it's along the same lines, or we'll talk to each other and figure out, okay, how should we solve this problem? The more people you get, the more backgrounds you have, and the more design philosophies you have.
Can the GNOME project learn from your experience in the KDE human interface guidelines and vice versa?
Oh, definitely. And a lot of the times whenever we look to the HIG a lot of times whenever we're trying to figure out, well, there are these two ways to do it. How does GNOME do it? And we'll look up to see what all our peers are doing. The differences in GNOME and KDE, we definitely learn a lot about. GNOME, for example, has implicit save, and that was really interesting to me. Do you know what I mean by implicit save? Implicit save is it saves automatically, so if you change something in a widget, it's changed, like the settings change. There's no apply, there's no okay, there's nothing like that. You just close the window either by clicking close or hitting that X or whatever. We have that in some specialized applications. It's not really practiced in KDE. We don't do that for any of our dialogues or any of our configuration settings. I have had a couple people ask me about it, and we just haven't done it. And I actually talked to MPT Matthew Paul Thomas about it, and we discussed it a little bit. And I'm really interested. I want to do some more research on it. But it's both that could be interesting, but users would have to learn it. But at the same time, I think it would be a cool experience. But at the same time, it would be so easily abused. I can think of tons of reasons where you wouldn't want to use that. But then as the guidelines author, I'm trying to figure out how do I explain when to use implicit save and when not to use implicit save to developers so that I don't have all these awful dialogues that are doing damage to somebody's computer because they go in and change a bunch of settings because they're following a guideline or how-to on the web. Then they realize that, oh, wait, I don't want to do this part yet. All their saves or all their changes are in there. And how do you revert back? Because even in GNOME, sometimes you have the revert button, sometimes you don't. Mm. So that can be very dangerous. Sometimes the settings are not that big of a deal, or sometimes the settings could be something that the user remembers. But what happens when they don't remember? Or if it's a lot of changes in one configuration dialog and they can't remember what they changed or how they changed it? That's the part that I'm worried about. So I learned something here. So,
well, it's definitely worthwhile you coming to UDS then, wasn't it?
Oh, I did more than that, but.
Well, it's been lovely talking to you. Thanks for sitting and spending some time with us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Enjoy the rest of UDS.
Okay, the competition. This time, we're going to do something slightly different.
Yeah, we decided the last one was far too easy and we didn't get any wrong answers. So this time we're going to set a question that will get wrong answers, guaranteed.
Loads and loads of them.
A little bit different. It's not just a question that we set and you email the answers in, because you have to go to the website and look at a photograph.
Yeah. We've got a stack of the latest Ubuntu CDs, DVDs, all stacked up in a pile. And basically all you've got to do is tell us how many are there. Dead easy.
Head over to the website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org. check out the photo, have your best guess as to how many there are, and the closest answer to the right amount will win the £20 voucher for the discount from the Canonical shop. If there's more than one answer that gets it spot on, it will draw randomly from those answers.
Email your answer to competition@ubuntu-uk.org.
Good luck, everybody.
So, Alan and Dave here. We're here with Mike Basiner, and he's from Utah, the USA. He's notable for his forums, and he's also on the CC, which is the Community Council. So, Mike, you got into the community through the forums. Is that correct to say?
Yes, that is. I got involved in Ubuntu sometime in the Hori period. I was using Fedora before that. I was a big Red Hat person. I'm actually a Red Hat certified engineer. And when Fedora 3 came out, would not work on my laptop. I couldn't get wireless working at all. I was going, well, this is great. And I've just been hearing about, in the background of the Linux community, about this new distribution called Ubuntu. And so I said, well, I'll try it out. Why not? And everything just worked. And it, like, within a week, I fell in love with Ubuntu. And then I discovered a community and been using it ever since and just been part of the community.
Okay, and the forums were quite new then, right?
Yeah, I was actually a moderator on the Fedora forums before then. And once I got involved with Ubuntu, I started working on the Ubuntu forums, started answering questions. I asked if I could become a member of staff, and they let me on, and been doing that for a while. A couple years ago at UDS, I went as a representative of the forums to create the forums council. And we worked with Ryan Troy, who's the person who created the forums, and Mark and the CC at the time. And we got the forums council created at UDS. And a couple of months later, after it was formalized, I was nominated to be a member of the forums council. And when I became a member of forums council, I also became administrator on the forums. Been doing that ever since. And then sometime before UDS Seville, Mark Shelfus sent me an email and asked me to be stand in for the community council. And they had a vote starting a week or two before UDS Seville. And during this UDS Seville, I actually found out that I did get elected to the community council. So I've been a member of the community council for basically a year, right? I got elected this time last year.
So what kind of stuff do you have to do as part of the community council? I guess you meet up, and what do they actually do within Ubuntu?
They are the provide the philosophical direction for Ubuntu. They don't make technical decisions as the job of the tech board, but they help mediate disputes, come with new policies and stuff like that that affects the whole community. They used to do membership approvals, but we've actually, since we've grown so much, and the Ubuntu community has grown so much, we've actually created new new membership boards to take care of that.
And these are the regional membership boards?
These are, the new regional membership boards. And one, we got one for the Americas, one for Europe, Asia, and Africa, and one for Australia, and I can't remember what else.
Australia and Asia. I can never remember either. It's all right. So as part of your community council stuff, you obviously have some level of responsibility, being a kind of, it's almost like the top level. It's not a hierarchy, but it's kind of seen as things get escalated up to the top level. So you're kind of an ambassador for Ubuntu, would you say?
I'd say I'm an ambassador for Ubuntu, but I feel it's more of a calming voice. I think, I don't think the community council that walks around with a stick and says, these are the rules of Ubuntu, please obey them. No, it's always just more of a calming influence, like get everybody to see each other's point of view, which, with a group like this, you're going to have so many different points of view. We just need to get everybody to understand, well, this person has this idea or this point, and this person has this idea and this point. And there has to be, even though they're different, we need to find a middle ground before we can continue forward on what Ubuntu wants to do.
And you're all based around the world. I know Mark Shuttle is mainly in the UK, and Elmo's on the community council. Elmo is James Troop, who's one of the sysadmins, lead sysadmin for Canonical. There's Mako and Matt East. Who else have we missed?
Corey Berger. Daniel.
And you're all based around the world, so you meet up online somehow? How often and where? And can other people kind of get involved, if you like, and see what's going on?
We have bi-weekly meetings, and they're listed on the Community Council page on the Wiki, on Ubuntu Wiki. We have one that's basically mid-afternoon European time, and one that's mid-afternoon American time. And they're usually on Tuesdays, and people can just come, you know, if they have something that they need to discuss to the Community Council, they can bring it up there.
And there's a Wiki page. If they've got a specific issue they want, they can raise it on the Wiki page, and that forms the agenda, is that right?
That's correct.
I know in the past some people have complained that the Community Council have had lengthy delays in doing stuff. Is that something you're hoping to resolve now?
I think we have resolved it. We've had 3 meetings on this new bi-weekly schedule, and we've made a firm commitment to keep to that, I believe. It was a mistake that we let that happen, that we let it slip so far. And once again, we took feedback from the community and got that resolved to make sure that doesn't happen again.
And now you're here at UDS in... What brings you here to UDS? What are you most interested in at UDS? Because this is not your first UDS, is it?
No, this is the 4th UDS I've been at. I usually do the community track. Usually, I try to find new things that the forums could do for the community. Provide advice to other community initiatives that have happened, like the be involved in the local council. We've talked about that at past UDSs, the IRC council, and just other community issues that get brought up.
Cool. So, is there anything any particular specific thing you're interested in, or is it just you want to get mainly in the community side of things? Is there any specific things?
Mostly just the community type stuff. Being a member of using Ubuntu forums, it's like I feel it's one of our more larger groups in Ubuntu. You know, we have about 500,000 registered accounts.
Wow.
And then about 80,000 active users since the release of Hardy. And that's just active registered users. The number of guests that visit is actually closer to 5 and 8 times that amount at any given time. So I think we've had close to 500,000 unique IPs hit the forum since Hardy. So it's a big community. I know one of the things I've been wanting to do is take those people who are new to Ubuntu, new to Linux, and take them from just getting Linux installed on a computer and to seeing the wider Ubuntu community. And so maybe I installed Ubuntu and wow, now what can I do? Well, I'm a pretty good artist. Well, okay, here's how you learn about the art team and do work for the art team. Or I'm good at writing technical documentation. Here's how you can learn how to become a member of the doc team and stuff like that. Because I think this is the forum is a great resource that other community teams could pull from and get more help in their volunteer efforts.
Yeah, there's a tremendous number of people. I mean, you've given us some numbers. There's a tremendous amount of people, but it doesn't seem like the developers and the people who actually work on the product seem to spend a tremendous amount of time, I'm not sure if this is the right phrase, but paying attention to the Ubuntu forums. Is that something you'd say was roughly accurate?
That's accurate. I don't think forums are the way that developers like to communicate, and I appreciate that. I understand that mailing lists don't work for some people, or IRC doesn't work for some people. That's the reason we have all these different services, because unlike the closed source world, we don't believe that one size fits all, and we're going to provide different options for different people to get the assistance they need. I think it would be great if more developers would talk on the forums. I think any time a developer comes on there, they're, treated like rock stars for the most part, so...
It seems that a lot of new users really just prefer forums. You get a lot of new, very new people on the forums, don't you?
Yeah, we get some people say, wow, I turned on my computer for the first time today, and I'm trying to figure out this computer thing. They're sometimes the newest of the new using the forums.
What are the main kind of issues that occupy your time as a forum moderator or forum administrator?
You get some people who demand help, I have this very specific question, and why isn't nobody helping? And this is, this is harshpucky, I can't believe I haven't got help. Or they'll just keep on bumping a thread, as we call it. It's when they ask a question and nobody's answered in 2 minutes, so they bump it and they say, please help me. And so we counter that a lot. And it's just a matter, it's just like everything else. You have to learn the proper etiquette of using forums and learn what to use, what tools there are in the forums, learn how to search it. And, you know, the great thing about the Ubuntu forums is that Google comes through like every day and searches it. So if you don't like using the forum search engine, you can always just search it through Google. And if you ask a question about Ubuntu on Google, you know, 9 times out of 10, the first answer about that will be a post from the forums.
Yeah, it is a tremendous resource.
I mean, as with other support avenues in the community, anyone can provide advice back to the user. How do you actually ensure that the answers given are actually of a qualitative answer?
Well, that's been a problem. Last year, we had a problem that everybody thought it would be funny to post, hey, type sudo rm/rf and see what happens. It does great things to your computer. So it actually, you know, it's just like everything else in the Linux community. It's a community effort. So if somebody gives a wrong answer or inappropriate answer, they're usually told, you know, shut up pretty quickly by other members of the community. So, you know, what we did add a feature recently is called the thanks feature. And the good thing about the thanks feature, if somebody posts a really good answer, you can click on this thanks button and see that a lot of people did appreciate this answer. It's a good way to judge what's quality content and what's not quality content. When you see thanks, if you see somebody's been thanked for a post, or actually say below the post, all these people said thanks for this answer.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Mike. It's been very interesting to hear about the forums and your work on the Community Council, and keep up the good work.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
It's David Popey at UDS here with Kurt von Fink from Canonical Support.
Hello, folks. My name's Kurt. I work for Canonical as a senior support analyst in the Montreal support office. We offer some various levels of support. We have, obviously, 24/7 support, also 9/5 support. That's offered in the 8-hour working day in your local time zone. So, for instance, if you're in the UK and you purchase a 9/5 support contract, you get support during the 5 business days of the week, but working hours for the UK. So you don't have to adjust your schedule to meet our schedule. We don't offer support for free, obviously, being a free software project and giving away the OS for free. Support is one of the ways we make money. So, you know, Canonical is dedicated to free and open source software, but we also have to succeed as a company. And so selling support is something, one way we can make money, support and services. We have a deal with Dell at the moment. If you purchase a brand new machine from Dell, as you go through the purchase process, of course, if you've ever shopped at Dell, you'll notice when you go to add things to your shopping cart, Dell asks you about a monitor. How about a bigger monitor? Would you like a printer? Would you like to make that a laser printer? Would you like a mouse? How about a three-button laser Bluetooth mouse? And a lot of people get frustrated and sort of just start paging through those questions, but I would recommend if you're buying a Dell, take a look for the basic support, which is 1 year of support from Canonical, and then starter support, which is 30 days of support from Canonical. If you're new to Linux and you think you're going to need a little help, I can honestly say that the best deal going on support from Canonical right now is for Dell customers. They get a better price than almost anybody.
What kind of mixture of users do you have?
Enterprise users, people running high-performance computing clusters, you know, massive installations with multiple hundreds of machines. We also have basic end users, Dell customers, who have purchased, you know, their first Linux laptop and just need a little help getting that going. So the kind of support customer we serve really covers a broad spectrum of usage cases. Officially, we only support packages that are in main and a select group of packages from Universe. But for those packages, we guarantee fixes. And obviously, if it's a closed source package, I'll pick on Adobe here and choose the Flash plugin. Since we don't have access to the source code, we can't guarantee a resolution if you encounter an issue. Now, we're never going to turn someone away and say, oh, we don't support that, and hang up the phone. We'll always provide a best effort in every case, but we can only guarantee to fix those packages that are in main. And in terms of the types of requests we get, sure, we get basic, simple, you know, I'm new to Linux, how do I add a printer? We also have people who are new to Ubuntu or new to a Debian distribution or even new to Linux, but they have a track record with Unix over the years. You know, they were Sys5 users or BSD users, and they have a bit more familiarity with how things work, and they're just looking to find out, how do we do things the Debian/Ubuntu way? So it really runs the gamut from very, very basic usage questions to more advanced issues covering advanced configuration of web servers. And this is even from home users. Clearly, the enterprise users have some very advanced questions. But even home users are, you know, how do I enable fast CGI instead of just CGI for my web server?
Why would a home user choose to use Canonical support rather than use the community support network?
Well, like I say, for packages in main and universe, we guarantee a fix, and you just simply can't get that guarantee from the community. There's an escalation path with Canonical support. We can guarantee we'll get developers looking into an issue.
Would you have a knowledge base of, you know, how to fix certain things, or do you rely on community documentation, or do you try not to, or how does that work?
It's both. I mean, I've been using Unix for a number of years, and certainly I'm quite skilled at it, but there are certainly people in the community with areas of expertise, particular areas of expertise, that exceed my own. And not availing myself of their expertise would just be foolish, and it would do a disservice to the customer. So, sure, we have our own little knowledge base of stuff that we use, and we consult each other, but we also do rely on the community documentation. Because, like I say, there are people in the community who have a particular focus on one small area of Ubuntu that we'll never be able to have. And these people know this area cold, and it would be a tremendous disservice to customers who have paid good money for support not to get the best support they can. And in many cases, that comes from the community. The community is a big part of support.
Does that mean there's a somewhat of a moral question to ask about, you know, someone's paying you money and you're using the support network that is free in some ways? Is there a conflict there, or is it just that information is out there, so you should use it, whether it was created by our community or the Gentoo community or some other community? It's just a resource that's online.
Well, I think that comes back to the basic principles of free software. If you're writing documentation with the expectation it's only going to be used in ways in which you approve, well, that's not really released under a free license, is it? You're putting expectations on it. The moral question, I think, is not what we take from the community, but because, like I say, if you write this information, anybody should be able to freely take it. I think the moral question is, what do we give back? If we encounter a community documentation page that has errors or has been outdated by new package changes, do we take the time to edit that documentation when we encounter it and improve it? And we do. It's important to be good community players, and if the community is providing you with great documentation or areas of expertise that you're not familiar with, it only makes sense to give back when you can and when it makes sense. And we all do that. It's part of our mandate to make sure that we work in concert with the community to provide support for customers.
How do you actually manage the language barrier? Because I'm sure a lot of your customers, English isn't their native language.
We have support analysts that speak German, French, and Spanish. You know, we would prefer that people use English, because every support analyst uses that language, and it's obviously the language of the forums, of IRC, apart from loco channels. But we're in the areas in which we're offering support through Dell in local languages, we do have people that speak those languages: German, French, Spanish, Portuguese.
If I wanted to sign up for a Canonical support contract, how would I go about doing it?
Just visit shop.canonical.com. If you look over on the right side, you can see some different categories of different swag you can buy, everything from bags to mouse pads to year-long support contracts. And you can actually purchase support right on the website. And it usually takes between 12 and 24 hours, depending on what time you sign up, UK time. The administrative offices are obviously in London. But within 12 to 24 hours, you'll be able to start submitting tickets and getting your questions answered. It's as easy as just visiting shop.canonical.com.
Brilliant. Well, thank you for this, and we look forward to seeing you again.
Yeah, thanks very much. I appreciate the time, and thanks to all the UK Linux users. We're glad to have you on board.
Okay, so Alan and Dave here with Mirko Müller, who's a Canonical employee, and you're here at UDS. Well, why are you here at UDS? Tell me what you get out of UDS and why you're here.
Well, first of all, like you just mentioned, I'm a Canonical employee, and I'm required to be here, very obviously, planning the new release, Intrepid, and Apart from having to be here, it's always nice to catch up, meet all the people you'll only know usually from ISC, and especially people from upstream GNOME who come here. It's always nice to see them in real life again, and just keep the reinforce the relationship and the contacts you have, and that's really nice. And apart from that, regarding the organization and all that, it feels very, very smooth. There's absolutely no stress whatsoever. You just look at the schedule, see what sessions you have to be at or you're leading or you're just interested in, and you just go there. It's very nicely organized.
Do you think it's improved over previous? I've bumped into you at a couple of previous UDSs. Has the way it's run improved since the last time you were here?
Yeah, seriously. The first one I was at was Mountain View, and of course there I was totally new to everything regarding that. Before then I only knew everything from outside, and that was the first look inside how a distro is actually put together and planned, and it was very intimidating. And then Sebastian Bacher said, well, you have to be at the session, and I was totally, totally nervous, and by now it's very relaxed and it's very, very smooth experience. It's really nice.
Tell us about some of the projects you've been involved with in before you started working for Canonical.
Well, I'm always interested in anything regarding computer graphics, especially UI and real-time 3D stuff. And Mark once introduced me at the Mountain View UDS as the King of Bling, and to some extent this nickname stuck with me. Probably the most prominent things I'm maybe known for are LoFET and the Cairo clock. Well, Cairo clock is an analog clock for the desktop, leveraging the nice things you get with composited desktops, using, like the name says, Cairo for all its rendering and SVGs for the theming. And then there's LoFET, which is my pet project that's currently idling for a few months now, sadly, but I might have some news regarding that. It's meant to replace the view we have of all our files on the system, get away from icons for files and treat every file as a first-class citizen, have everything visible right now. You don't need viewing applications for videos or images or PDF documents. Everything is just there, and if you want to take a closer look at it, you can just zoom in, arrange them in a very natural way. And that's meant at some point, if I advance it further, to become part as additional view for Nautilus. But that's sadly only a spare time project, so it will take some time.
So Mirko, what projects are you actually working on now?
Right now I'm working on a face browser for GDM, which is planned to land in Intrepid.
For those people who don't know what GDM is, can you just explain what GDM is and how this affects GDM?
Well, GDM, that's the abbreviation for the GNOME Display Manager, and that's the part of the system that you see initially when you log in, where you enter your login ID and your password. And the face browser is a part of a GDM which is a little bit graphically more pleasing. So you see images of the users that are registered with the system. So you can click on the image and then enter your password. Or, well, it's planned to have something like a type ahead feature, similar to list views. So when you start typing, you only get to see the users or the user faces which match that pattern, and completions would only go up to a certain level. So it kind of deals as a filter for the list of images or users you see.
So if you had Alice, Alan, and Dave registered on the system, and you just type AL, Dave would disappear, and the others would, and then you could click.
That's the idea. If you don't have many users on the system, which is the usual case for private systems and your home computer, then you don't have that much, and it probably doesn't make sense. You probably click right away because you can identify that image very fast, and it's very big to hit that with a mouse. But let's say you have 20 or 50 users and you start typing, then that filters down the list and it becomes more apparent. You probably are able to locate the image you want to click on faster. So it's apart from making the system look nicer and be more visually consistent and as pleasing as the rest of the desktop with compass and all these effects. It's also a convenient feature for people who are not touch typists and type very fast, so they just want to click something and then go further and enter the password.
I guess this is something that people will be familiar with from other operating systems like Windows and the Mac, where you just click on someone's user ID, but you're trying to take it a bit further than that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I'm a bit surprised that something like that didn't come yet with macOS 10 or Vista. Their ways of doing these kinds of things are a little bit too, let's say, conservative. I would have imagined to be a little bit more interesting and more eye-pleasing, but, well, if they don't do it, then we'll have a chance to surpass them.
Part of the reason for it not being not a lot of focus being on the logon screen, because it's a kind of transitional screen. It's not something, it's like a splash screen. It's not something you look at all day. I mean, some people do, because they sit there staring at a desktop before they log on, you know, and trying to get inspiration or something. But it's kind of one of those. But it's one of the little things, isn't it? It's not a major thing. That's I'm not true. Trying to belittle what you're doing, but it's not like a major part of the desktop. Do you see what I mean?
That's true. I mean, you only will experience that for a few seconds, and that's it. But it's part of the experience, and the first thing you see when you log onto the system, or for example, for people who are totally new to Linux and install and will be installing the new version of Intrepid, then. That's the first thing they will see, and that's the first impression they will get from the system. And if we can polish that as so early on, it just completes and makes the whole feel of the system that bit more slick. And I mean, that's also a part of being human. Just like when you eat, you like your food to look nice, and you like your computer or your computer experience to be nice. Well, it's a little touch, but. In your subconsciousness, yeah, well, you recognize that, and it gives you that feel that you're using a proper system. It can be as rock solid and as well architected under the hood. If it's not looking nice and pleasing, you just have not an as good experience. You will always go with the better looking product. If you have product A and product B, they're both technically as advanced and as solid. If product A is looking better than product B, people go with product A, so no matter what. That's part of the reason we are doing these kinds of things.
Possibly one of the things that people might have a concern about is GDM is something that appears before you've logged on. So there are certain security implications with that. You know, you don't want to allow people to break GDM or the face browser. And are these kind of security concerns things that you have to take into account? Are there anything special you have to think about? Or is this not something you really need to worry about right now? Or what's your take on that?
The main concerns regarding security is revealing information about the user in terms of their faces or in terms of their, usernames. So most sysadmins would probably like, oh, no face browser and no revealing of the usernames and whatsoever. But, there's the kind of a middle line or a compromise you have to make. So, for example, regarding user faces, the idea is to hook up things like Cheese or MeMaker with the GDM setup tools. So when you set the user photos, for example, if the policy of a system admin says, well, no real photos, then, for example, you could use MeMaker, which is kind of a South Park-ish tool to render abstract representations of a user, so you can click your image together with SVG elements, and it's also a kind of a fun, nice thing for setting up a new user, and the first thing you do, you get a playful experience for setting up something like that. Or the other idea is, if photos are okay, hook up something with Cheese, so you have a webcam attached to that system, then you could use Cheese to generate your login photo, for example.
On the Mac, that's something they integrate with the first setup, isn't it? The first run.
Yeah,
I've only seen this once, but I remember
this. That's true. They have that on the Mac, on the machines that have webcams built in. I think the iMacs and the notebooks have these attached in their case, and that's a very nice feature, and that's pretty nice. And why not use that also for free systems?
Okay, you mentioned you were working on some other things as well. Do you want to tell us a bit about them?
If I have the time, I always try to get as much as possible done for example, low-fat, which is currently in a redesign phase, at least in my mind, because since dealing with clutter while writing the Face browser, I saw that clutter has already made it far enough to be a viable solution to base LowFat on. Right now it's still plain OpenGL, and because I don't have that much time and I also want to attract at some point additional contributors from outside, using something like clutter, which is getting more and more popular and nicer to use by the week, it would be nice to base it on that. One thing I want to work on in, let's say, the next 2 or 3 weeks to get the long-promised design document out so people get a better idea. Sharing a room here with Neil Patel, who is probably also well known for his work on the Event Window Navigator, who's also a very experienced Clutter user, and he used to work at OpenHand and use Clutter, and he also said so he would really love to help with LowFat if I would be using Clutter, and I said well that's also a good reason to switch to Clutter. So that's the one big thing I have in mind for my spare time stuff.
So for people who aren't aware of what LowFat is, I know you've put demos on your website. What's the URL to your website?
Well, my website, my blog is maxlow.thepimp.net. I was donated that URL. I didn't choose it by myself. So, and then I have the source code repository of LowFat at free desktop Git. It's git web free desktop .org, and then there's this huge list of those projects. And if you just search for LowFat, you will get to the project and the Git clone URL.
And for people who possibly haven't seen it and are trying to conceptualize in their mind what you're talking about, would it be fair to say it's similar to some other projects? Would it be fair to say like Microsoft Surface and other what other projects are related to this that get you excited?
That's true. The Microsoft Surface is something which is more or less the same. Well, at least from the looks and the behavior, not from the ideas for integrating that into the desktop. As far as I know, it's only a separate product which is bound to hardware Microsoft's selling. And there's something else from a researcher at New York University, I think. It's Dr. Jeff Hahn, who did the first real solid multi-touch demonstration, and when I saw that, I said, oh my god, I need that kind of hardware for LowFat, because right now you only have the mouse, one mouse cursor to manipulate that, and I'm really excited that in a few weeks, hopefully, MPX will be landing in an Xorg upstream, so we get this multi-pointer input stuff for X, but it will be a lot of work to make toolkits multi-pointer aware, and to have the needed framework in place, so once you get the capable hardware in your hands, you can start using that. I mean, and on a per-application basis, I think it will probably be possible to do that. So it will be possible to use MPX by just using X input. So, you have to get around the toolkit for that, but if you want to get multiple fingers working in your application, well, then if you can do it, then you should do it and just not wait for GDK. And then on the other hand, we need some kind of projects to really collect experience with that. And I think LowFat is a good playing ground for that. And if it's just a research test bed, then that's okay too, because, it's all about open source, trying out stuff.
Yeah, well, thanks for coming to tell us about that. And I think we look forward to seeing this Face browser in the next release. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
So that's it. End of the episode. And end of all the UDS interviews.
The guys at the Lug Radio podcast wanted us to mention their Lug Radio Live event, which is happening in July, and they sent us this little trailer.
On the 19th and 20th of July, Lug Radio brings you the coolest conference of the year, with over 30 speakers and exhibitors from around the world.
Chris DeBona,
Max Spivak,
KDE,
Steve Lamb,
Matthew Garrett,
Mike Mark,
James Hooker,
Kevin Sandon,
Iculus,
RD,
Ubuntu UK,
Daniel James,
Emma Jane Hopkins,
Open Rights Group,
Bruno Board,
Ben Thorpe,
Rufus Pollock,
Linux Outlaws,
Sam Birchall,
John Carr,
Christian Scheller,
Edward Hervey,
64 Studio,
William J. Giddings,
Rob McQueen,
Agustina Rita,
Linux Emporium,
Robert Cohen,
Chris Hayes,
Benjamin Elkin,
William Anderson,
Matthew Rogers.
We'll be right back.
Lug Radio Live, UK 2008.
The Lighthouse Media Centre in Wolverhampton, England. Entrance is just £5 for both days. International visitors getting free.
Lugradio.org/live.
Yeah, we're all going to be at Lug Radio Live this year, so we might be doing some work whilst we're up there. Not only crewing the actual event, but we might do some podcast stuff whilst we're up there too.
Yep, so if you see us and you want to come along and say hello and tell us how much you love our podcast, feel free to do so.
As ever, we're always after your feedback, so you can email us at podcast@ubuntu-uk.org.
Or you can leave us a voicemail. The voicemail number is on the website.
Or you can join us at Twitter. It's twitter.com/UUPC.
And you can find us on Facebook. Search for Ubuntu UK Podcast on the Facebook groups and you'll find us.
And of course the website podcast.ubuntu-uk.org.
Yeah, and that's about it for now. We'll see you next time.
Cheers.